Yes, the same kind of story seems to come down from long ago. Two friends having coffee together when something flies by their window. It might be out on that lawn, which is wide, at least half of the playing field. Because there's no explaining what your imagination can make you see and feel. Somebody like me, you're hypnotized.
From the City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Tonight, the mysteries of the Knights Templars with our very special guest, Lionel Fenthorpe, as we go live to England in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lionel Fenthorpe was born in England, has worked as a journalist and teacher. He is currently the Director of Media Studies at Cardiff Academy and is a fully ordained Anglican priest working part-time and unpaid for the church in Wales. Lionel is president of ASSAP, that's the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, and he's also the president of BUFORA, the British UFO Research Association. He is now a very popular television and radio presenter and celebrity guest on chat shows. Lionel is also the author of more than 250 books. Lionel, you must be writing every day of your life.
Well, I think I do a few words every day. Some days the pressure goes on.
Indeed. Good to talk with you again, my
friend.
And you.
It's wonderful to be back on your show. Thank you for the invitation.
You are one of our favorites. You know that? They love you here.
Great.
You ever get to the United States?
Yes, I do. We were in L.A. about a year ago, and I only wish we'd had time to come and see you.
Oh, my gosh.
The station. We just got back from Hawaii, where we were investigating the legend of the were-shark, which was a very mysterious tale.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, it was because I'm interested in the psychological and sociological background of the various mysteries. And when you get legends of werewolves, they tend to be in areas where there are lonely, bleak, forested mountains, where the wolves were running until just a few years ago, sometimes into the last century. And so the villagers there tended to create stories about people who had been, when they'd been killed by ordinary biological wolves, that it was something mysterious called a werewolf. Now, in Hawaii, where the background, of course, is totally different, and the area around Kauai, the people who are the victims of shark attack, however rare that may be, but it does happen.
More so now than before, I think.
Yes, I think so. And the story there arises of this mysterious, sinister creature, the were-shark, who, when he's on land, appears to be a perfectly normal human being, usually quite a good-looking guy, and attracts the ladies and makes friends with the boys. And then he says to one of his new friends, "Would you like to come swimming with me?"
Oh, yes.
And the minute he gets back into the water, he resumes his shark shape, and the friend doesn't come back.
Maybe that's where we got the term, that person's a shark.
Yeah, it could well be. Uh-huh. Yeah, I like that. But that's what we were doing there. And then we came back, when we flew back from Kauai, we stopped over at L.A. just for 12 hours because we had to wait for the flight from L.A. back to London.
Well, next time you do that, you call me.
I will, I promise. Yeah, that would be wonderful.
I had a great opportunity to read an incredible article that you and your wife, Patricia, put together called The Mysteries of the Templars. And I've got to tell you, and this is the first time for me, that all of this just began to make sense. You know, in the past for me, it was a little confusing. Who were these individuals? What were they trying to do? What a great mystery, Lionel.
Oh, it is. It's absolutely fabulous, George. I said, Patricia and I have been working on unsolved mysteries of various kinds for 40 years and more, and this is certainly one of the most intriguing and amazing things that we've ever come across. And it's just like, do you remember there was a series mainly for children called Doctor Who a few years ago?
Yeah.
And Doctor Who had a TARDIS, which looked like an old-fashioned English police telephone box in the days before the police had radios. And the TARDIS, as they called it, was very small on the outside, but once you got inside, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. It had this mysterious quality of being bigger internally than externally. And so we would all always describe the Templar mystery and the associated mystery of Rennes Le Chateau as being like Doctor Who's TARDIS. It's a heck of a lot bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. And it just started off with, there were nine men who went to the Templar mystery. Nine men went to Jerusalem, and they were there to guard the pilgrims. And then we begin to find out that they were digging for something under the Dome of the Rock, in an area that had been closely associated with the great, good, wise King Solomon. And then you begin to wonder what they were digging for. And so, from the mystery of nine men who go to protect pilgrims, you find an archaeological dig. What were they hunting for? Then you open up all the questions of the things that it might have been, and then the questions of, if there were strange things there, who put them there and why? And it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, and you're right. Who put them there and why are the two big questions. And then what? Because I'm beginning to think maybe under the Dome of the Rock that they might have uncovered the Ark of the Covenant and they brought it there. That's my guess.
It's certainly, I think, a very wise and a very well-founded guess. It's one of the guys like you and me who love the arcane and the mysterious and the esoteric. We have to look at this with open minds, don't we, as you always do, and to look around a problem and say, that's theory one, and here are my reasons. And then there's theory two, and my reasons. And we, all like honest jurors in a court of law, we have to juggle these things, don't we? And to say, well, I like that witness. I'm not quite so sure about the second witness. But that piece of evidence the third witness brought in, that's the one we've got to pursue further. And I would say to, you know, all our friends, the listeners who share our interest in unsolved mysteries and unraveling these things, that the human mind is like a parachute. It works best when it's open.
Let's go back to the beginning of the Ark of the Covenant for a moment, Lionel, because I want to put it in perspective with your investigation of Rennes Le Chateau. The Ark of the Covenant, based on what the Bible says, was created to hold the Ten Commandments. Am I correct?
Absolutely. Yes, that's the biblical account. Now, one of the things that astounded me, and I'm talking here as an ordinary Anglican, or what I think in the USA we call Episcopal priest, and I would say that's a straightforward, that's fine. From my point of view, when I'm in church or preaching to my people, looking at the biblical account, that seems to be what the Bible tells us. Now, I was amazed, because of my, you know, basic church background and my studies in that area, to find that there were arks in ancient Egypt long before Moses and the Israelites of the Exodus created what we call today the Ark of the Covenant.
And to people who are tuning in, we're not talking about a Noah's Ark, not a boat. This is something else.
Indeed it is. It's if we could imagine it as a box, and a box that would be of a size that two men could carry, slung on poles, one at each end, rather like those traditional pictures we see of huntsmen carrying a deer back on poles on their shoulders. It was designed to be carried in that way.
Or the way I have my staff, Lionel, bring me into the studio every night.
You know? Hey, got to tell you that just very, very quickly, George, lovely story about being carried into the studio. There was a lovely story about two guys who went to the Vatican and who wanted to, you know, to meet the Holy Father, and they'd never been there before, and they'd never been to Italy before, so they asked about whether they'd got any of the wine that these boys drank at home, and they hadn't. So they then said, well, what does the Holy Father drink? And they were told by the barman that he drank creme de menthe, which is that, you know, that lovely peppermint flavor,
right,
pure,
right.
Wonderful stuff. My mother used to love it. And so they said to the barman, not knowing anything about it, can we have 2 pints of that, please?
Oh, no.
So they knocked back 2 pints, and one said to the other, now I know why the Holy Father has to be carried.
That's right. I love it.
Yeah, but it's just had this lovely picture of you or me coming into the studio on one of those beautiful chairlifts. But
right.
Anyway, the Ark, coming back to the Ark, one of the great mysteries is that in the detailed description of it, in the Bible account, it has to be carried through these poles, through loops, through rings that hold the poles.
Because it's so heavy, right?
Yeah, because it's and there are some researchers who have wondered whether it is to act as an insulator.
Correct.
Many years ago, I worked on the electricity board in the UK. When I was a youngster, I was working in the stores there, and I learned quite a lot about it by, you know, talking to the professional electricians when they told me what they needed out of the stores. And one of the things I learned about was these big poles that the lads used when they had to do any connecting or disconnecting on the very high voltage cables. And it always struck me that the poles that were used for that, these insulated safety poles that the wiremen used, were remarkably like the things that went through the rings on the Ark of the Covenant. And it's very possible that there was some super technology involved there. But another factor about that Ark is that I have a theory that when Egyptian charioteers were sent to bring back the Israelites. You remember Pharaoh changed his mind.
Yes, through the Red Sea.
And they went through the Red Sea and were drowned when the Red Sea returned. Now, Pharaoh, whatever his faults, was not a fool. He was an experienced military commander. And the last thing you do is to send the best, the flower of your chariots, because they were very expensive. It's like sending out, you know, high-tech military vehicles that are worth $2 or $3 million
exactly.
Each.
Soften them up first. Send your lesser valued things.
That's right. And so why on earth did he send, especially on a treacherous, wet area, these vital chariots, which he was in great danger of losing, unless he was after something of immense value?
Good point.
Now, the theory that occurred to me, and again, you know, when you and I were saying earlier that we just lay our theories out in a row and examine them and put up the evidence, let's imagine that Moses, who had been brought up as an Egyptian prince, knew a great many of the secrets of the Egyptian hierarchy and the Egyptian royalty, and he knew that in Egypt there was this very powerful, one of many, arks, because there are pictures of these Egyptian arks which were produced many years before the Israelites ever went to Egypt. They're very ancient indeed. And suppose that Moses had taken with him one of these vitally important technological marvels on which Egyptian power depended.
True.
And Pharaoh goes ballistic.
Right.
And he says to him, I want that back at any cost. Get the chariots out there, bring that man back, and bring the ark back.
Because maybe the Egyptians didn't know how to rebuild them or duplicate them.
Oh, that's a marvelous idea, Judge. I think that could be right. Look, if you and I had been living in the Dark Ages in England after the Romans left, there would have been things like Roman villas left behind with those wonderful hypocaust, central heating in a villa. We've been used to living in a sort of mud hut or a shack or a shed or a peasant's hovel somewhere. We're Dark Age Anglo-Saxon peasants or British peasants. And then these Roman wizards come in and they build these luxury villas, and after they go, hey, we want to go and live in the luxury villa which the Roman masters have just left, and we don't know how to work any of the things, so that if any of those things, any of their Roman technical marvels broke down, or we couldn't repair them.
That's
we
right.
could use them, but we couldn't replace them. And I think that's a parallel with that great idea of yours. The thing was irreplaceable. They could use it, but they didn't know how to build another one.
And they probably didn't have a lot of them.
No, they must have been. Well, from what we hear of the history of the Ark in the Bible, it seems to have possessed immense power.
Do you remember the Indiana Jones movie?
Oh, I do. That wasn't that
Ark of the Covenant? And when they finally found it, One of the, I think one of the Nazi soldiers went to touch it or open it.
Yes.
And he got electrocuted and he disintegrated.
Yeah. By the force and power inside it. And I think that wonderful Indiana Jones movie was, really on the ball. Incidentally, just digressing for a minute on wonderful movies, and this is at the heart of all those mysteries that you and I love. I've recently seen a new DVD of a movie called The Village, and the mystery there is that there are strange creatures in the forest outside the village, and they are so feared that the villagers speak of them as those we do not speak of.
Mm-hmm.
And just like that great Indiana Jones movie, there's so much in a really good mystery movie that it reflects real life. And so when investigators like you and myself are looking into a real life mystery, and we see a good film, a good movie about mysteries, like the Indiana Jones, then we like it, and it teaches us things because it relates to the reality of our world. So the best mysteries are kind of parallels to the real world that we live in, and there's a sort of blurred edge, as there is in the Da Vinci Code, between fact and fiction.
Absolutely.
And I don't know whether you use the same term in the USA, George, but we call that faction here in the U.S.
No, we don't say that here.
It's obviously, just the putting together of the two words, fact and fiction, and you come up with F-A-C-T-I-O-N, faction, which, has lots of other meanings as well.
Yeah, we use it as a group or, particular group of people.
Within politics.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's one of the factions in the party.
Right.
Yeah, we use it that way as well, but it's got this, we've kind of pulled it across in literature and made it a sort of jargon word.
Well, let's assume then for a moment that the Ark of the Covenant, whether there was one or five of them, was a capacitor, some kind of electrical box. It was a power source.
Right.
But if it was a power source, and even if the commandments were in there or not the point yet, if it happened to be a power source, what do you think they used it for?
Well, one of the lines, again, we come back to that marvelous Indiana Jones movie in which we say that one of the characters there says, the Ark is a radio for talking to God. Now, if we can assume without any irreverence that it wasn't a radio for talking to the God we believe in as the God of the universe, but was a means of communicating with some very strange and powerful beings who had come across maybe from another galaxy.
Exactly.
And that their powers were so great. If we look outside our Christian beliefs in the one great God of the universe that shared by many of the great faiths, then we find that in some of the earlier religions, the gods were never single gods. They were a pantheon god. You had the big guy in charge, who, if we look at it in military terms, think of Star Trek for a moment. He's Captain Kirk. He's the man in charge. And then he has various assistants. You have Dr. Spock, and you have Spock, the science officer, and you have Bones, the doctor, and Scotty, the engineer. And so there are other senior people with special responsibilities. Now, if we transfer that to the pantheons of the elder gods, you've got the Zeus figure.
Zeus was Kirk, right?
Yeah, he was Kirk. And then, of course, you have the god of healing. That's often associated with the sun god. And so you then bring in all the others, and you find that each has a particular domain of expertise. And it is so like the when you've got Mars, the god of war, okay, he'd be the chief security officer.
Exactly. The chief medical officer would be the chief of something. Poseidon, who was in charge of your seas.
Yeah,
maybe he was the submarine force.
Yeah, he was the admiral, maybe. Yep. He was the admiral of your submarine force. And so it's not difficult to translate these old pagan or heathen pantheons up in the North Country here in Scandinavia, where Denmark and Sweden and Norway, where they have their Norse gods, and you have Father Odin, and then you have Thor, the god of war, and you have other gods of healing and gods who will assist you with your farming. And so it's almost as if you'd got an advisor, just as we send out, don't we, young volunteers who are very gifted and helpful and who will go and help in less developed countries.
Or those, let's say, who helped in the tsunami relief.
Yes, those wonderful men who went across there and did all they could to put things right. And so if there'd be, especially if there'd been a disaster on the Earth, and somebody out there in a flying saucer, you know, in a UFO or a spaceship from some other distant part of the universe comes across, sees us struggling, sees our Neolithic ancestors struggling with a flood or whatever it was, and comes along to help us.
Stay with us, Lionel. We'll take this quick break. Also, think about the possibilities that the Ark was a resurrection machine. I'll talk with you about that, because all this is going to lead us into the Knights Templars, because for some reason, they were responsible for this. And how did that happen? And why?
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505. On the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And our very special guest tonight, Lionel Fanthorpe. And we'll be back with Lionel in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hearing ghost stories, that's what it's all about. Well, I just got my own February issue of the After Dark newsletter, and it is a dandy. If you'd like to get it, call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. You can also go to coasttocoastam.com. Now, the living life of the CD you're going to get, Mel's Hole, when you renew or subscribe, will only be for this month. So take advantage of it if you've been on the fence. 1-888-727-5505 or online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Lionel Fanthorpe. Lionel, let's assume for a moment also that the Ark of the Covenant, maybe it wasn't a capacitor, maybe it wasn't an electrical source or a device to talk to those who brought it. Maybe it was a resurrection machine. Did you ever think about that?
Yes, that's a fascinating idea. And when we think about the mysteries of what modern science is doing, and I was fascinated to hear that, you know, you've got a scientist coming on the show very soon to talk about some of these amazing new developments, that we just begin to see the edges of what life really is and whether or not it can be restored. We know though these hopefuls who have put themselves into cryogenic chambers, trusting that the medicine of the future will not only be able to cure what they died of, but will be able to resurrect them. And the more we know about life, then it seems to me that the greater are the possibilities that medical science will one day discover keys that at the moment we are only just guessing about. So if Let's go back to the idea of the classic horror films with Baron Frankenstein.
I love those.
Yeah, I did too. I used to love the Boris Karloff one, you know. I'd have dreams about it when I was a boy. And if we go back to that, it's always electricity that brings the monster back. You remember the lightning on the roof
exactly.
of the castle?
Exactly. Whatever the soup was that was in life, it needed that electrical spark.
Yep. And, of course, with all the recent research, when we managed to get that observation ship down to the satellite of Jupiter, you know, you're beginning to wonder just what is going on in that primeval soup, which is a lovely way to describe it. And then the electric spark comes in, the big power comes in, right. The energy, the thrust. Well, if we think about that possibility, that life as we understand it, you know, from geological time, seems to have needed a huge input of energy, then a resurrection machine, a thing that had a vast input of energy, and if we take a much more easily understood, you know, all these dramatic hospital films, and you've got to bring the guy back, he's passed out, so you've got to resuscitate him, and of course the doctors use an electrical impulse,
yes,
don't they?
That's right, paddles they put
We've seen that in so many really good dramas. Now, if you have something like that on a bigger scale, maybe the electricity could be, or the power, could be a form of energy that we do not yet understand, because as science progresses, we learn about more and more forms of energy which can change from one to the other. We've got light, we've got heat, we've got sound, we've got electricity. What if, and this goes back almost to some of the ideas of the alchemists, that there is what they would have called a fifth element over and above earth, air, fire, and water.
Uh-huh.
Something quintessential, which we might even begin to think of as the essence of life. Now, if that Egyptian machine had got some technique way beyond the technology of the time for harnessing or for transforming normal energy into this fifth form, this quintessential thing, this essential power of life, did they really have something that would bring people back? Now, another thought that occurs to me on this fascinating door that you've just opened here, George, is the idea of the pyramids and the hope of resurrection of the pharaohs.
Oh, perfect. Exactly.
So, if the people from the stars who had brought the resurrection machines with them, just in case one of their people got accidentally killed. Okay, so you put him in the resurrection machine and you bring him back.
Yep.
It was for them what first aid kits would be for us. And after they've gone back, the Egyptian people, having observed them resurrecting their own when they were injured or killed, think that they can do it as well, but of course they don't understand the power of the machine. What if that resurrection machine had some sort of pyramidal form? Because science is now beginning to tell us that the shape, the form, the volume of the pyramid can focus things. You and I have had encounters with friends who have been into this pyramid shape and who have said, well, you can put a razor inside one and it would sharpen your razor.
Exactly.
For you, or keep it sharp. Now, if the pyramid was a vital part, if this particular shape was a vital part of the machine, and long after the visitors from space, the Egyptian gods, in inverted commas, had gone back to where they came from, then the people that they'd left behind have got half an idea, quarter of an idea, and they think that if you build a pyramid shape and put a human being into it after he's dead, he'll come back to life. And of course, they haven't got the technology that the original resurrection machine had, unless one has been left behind.
And that's what they wanted.
And that's what they wanted.
You know, and it could very well have been a transmitter, the pyramid itself.
Yes, indeed. You see, if we think about the way that we use dish aerials and that we use the points of pyramids, the pyramid shapes, to focus energy, then it's a perfect shape for a transmitter. And of course, if you invert the thing, you've got a rectangular version of a dish aerial, so that you could receive from one area and transmit from the other. And again, if we think of all the strange theories about the tectonic plates which make up the Earth's surface. Now, when two tectonic plates rub together, there is the most enormous power generated. That power, which is normally destructive and terrible, and comes as earthquakes and causes things like the tsunami disaster.
Sure.
But what if that power could be harnessed? What if, just as in some very advanced alternative energy source technologies, people are using wave motion from the sea, and others are using geothermal heat to help to solve the world's energy problems. What if this super race, these hyper technologists from out there, had a technique of using moving tectonic plates with enormous mass and force and energy, and they just transferred that energy, not as heat, but if you have a machine like a simple roof tile, which will transform sunlight into electric power, you know, through that sort of cellular transformation of light into electricity or of heat into electricity through one of those little cells. Suppose they had a gadget which would take the dynamic power, the kinetic energy of those moving plates, which is astronomically great, and simply transform it into another source of power that they wanted and could use. Maybe that was one of the ancient Egyptian secrets. Maybe the Ark could plumb in underneath there and take that power up. And of course, that's why the pyramids have got that shape. Huge base taking up Earth power and transmitting it out through the point in a highly focused beam.
That's so true. Absolutely so true. And regardless of what it was used for then, obviously it made its way back to the Middle East.
Yes.
And do you believe it was buried under the Dome of the Rock?
I think that is as strong a possibility as any. But there is another line of thinking that it made its way to Ethiopia. And that is a fascinating thought as well, because in Aksum, in Ethiopia, there are sanctuaries, one of which is believed to hold what they refer to as the Ark of the Covenant. Now, that takes us back to the legends and the mysteries. And these are, it's what we were saying in the beginning about the TARDIS. These mysteries are an awful lot bigger inside than they are outside. But if we could just link in here with the great and good and wise King Solomon, and the Bible refers to a visit from the Queen of Sheba. Now, Sheba is thought by some researchers to have been what we would today call Ethiopia. And when the Bible refers rather coyly in that quaint early English to, and he sort of gave her all that her heart desired, well, this could be a rather genteel euphemism for he made her pregnant. So the Queen of Sheba, Solomon said, "What would you like, my dear?" And she said, "Well, I'd love to be the mother of one of your children because you're so wise." So she goes back and bears a son who then becomes Menelik, who is the founder of the Ethiopian dynasty, and his name means, in English, the son of the wise man. And the story is that when he grew up, his mother gave him the ring that Solomon had given to her, and that he goes back to Jerusalem, where Solomon receives him gladly and recognizes him, and sends him back with a group of young Hebrew courtiers and young princes and nobles and the top people, and says, "Take this with you for safety, my son." And the Ethiopian legend is that Solomon gave the ark to his son Menelik, who was the son of the beautiful black queen Makeda of Ethiopia.
And there are some who believe then that the ark may be in some kind of tent now in Ethiopia?
Yeah, it's believed to be in a sanctuary where only one guardian of this very old sort of Ethiopian set of beliefs is able to see it. And in some of the books that have been written about where the ark could possibly be, and some very well-respected researchers have suggested that that's where it is. And one of the old Ethiopian guardians maintained that it was there. And there's a link, another interesting piece of mystery there, with ancient trumpets. And we mentioned these in one of the Temple Mystery books that we've done recently. And the trumpets which the Ethiopians produced, we can't bring the Ark out and show you, but we can show you these, and they were ancient Hebrew trumpets of the kind that were blown in the religious ceremonies. And you remember when they blew the trumpets when the wall of Jericho came?
Yes, okay.
So trumpets were associated with the Ark of the Covenant, which was also there when the walls of Jericho were destroyed. And those trumpets which the Ethiopians produced were practically identical to the ones on the famous Arch of Titus in Rome, showing the treasures being brought back. Now, it looks as if those particular ancient musical instruments and their unique form can help us to date whatever it was that the ancient religious people of Ethiopia claim that they've got hidden away in Aksum. So just like you can use radiocarbon dating if you've got a living, so you can use one artifact from an old period of history to say, well, if these two things went together, and thing one is 3,000, 4,000 years old and is of a particular pattern, well, the thing that's associated with it can be dated from the design and manufacture of the item we can see.
Now, let's jump ahead just a little bit here now.
Fine.
Tell us a little bit about Rennes-le-Château. What is this area in France?
Yeah, there was a mystery there that was one of the most intriguing ever. In the year 1885, and Rennes is a tiny mountaintop village in the southwest of France, and there in 1885, an impoverished parish priest named Beranger Saunier was awarded the living, was granted the living of Rennes-le-Château. Now, I'm trying to translate this swiftly into our modern currency, but his stipend at the time was £6 English, was the equivalent of £6 English in a year. So, £6 a year, that's right. So it worked out. If we think of those as dollars, to be quick and easy, the guy got 50 cents a month to live on. So he was really.
Now,
what
would that be if they equated it to today's dollar?
Well, if we equated it to today's dollar, he would be getting something like
$500 a month or more than that?
Nowhere near, much less than that.
Okay.
Is it maybe $100, $150?
Okay.
He'd have been getting something like $3 a day to live on. And what he did was to go around his parishioners. I mean, we just use that to suggest how very, very limited was the income of that church and how very poor the priest was. So he then had to go around and say to his parishioners, John, could I have lunch with you on Wednesday? And Sally, could I have supper with you on Friday? Just to eat. And he sort of went around making his parochial visits so that he didn't impose on his parishioners, who were nearly as hard up as he was. It was a very poor area. Anyway, suddenly all this changes, and he's spending money as if there's no tomorrow, and the people who invited him in, shall we say, for a slice of bread or a cup of soup, they are now invited back to the presbytery, and there's a 7-course meal, and there's wine between every course, and eat all you like and have all you like. He goes traveling all over the place. He goes off to Paris. He makes the acquaintance of Emma Calvet, who was a beautiful opera star and was also known to be, what should we say, if you could really afford her, she would be your girlfriend.
Oh,
it was high
one of those high-maintenance types.
Yeah, very high-maintenance lady. And he could afford her company. And one way and another, he built all kinds of things at Rennes. He completely, completely refurbished the church, which was semi-derelict when he got there, and he filled it with statues and paintings and carvings and all kinds of lovely ornaments and thoroughly restored the structure, and he built himself a sort of folly watchtower right on the edge of the mountain top, and he built orangeries and you name it, a luxury villa called the Villa Bethania. There was no doubt at all that this man had suddenly got practically unlimited spending power. And the great mystery of Rennes-le-Château is, where did Beranger Saunier get that money? And one of the theories is that it was ancient Templar treasure that had been hidden when the Templars were attacked in 1307.
Did he find it? Was he given it?
Well, this, again, is part of the great mystery. It seems as if he found something, because I've actually known and spoken with a guy called Marcel Captier. Now, Marcel Captier was the gardien of the village when we visited it on one of our many visits, and his great-grandfather had actually been the bell ringer and verger for Rennes-le-Château Church when Béranger Saunier was the priest. And this is the story that Marcel, the great-grandson of this church officer, told us. He said that his great-grandfather had found an old wooden pulpit support, which was, I've seen it, I had my hands on it. It's a wooden pillar about 3 feet high. And it had at one time been a sort of ornamental support in the church. And it had got damaged and fallen sideways. When the verger went to pick it up, he found that there was a secret compartment in it. Now, I've had that thing in my hand, and I've slid the piece of wood that operated the secret compartment. So I'm talking first-hand investigation here. And behind it, according to his great-grandson Marcel Captier, there was a little glass vial of the kind that sacred relics used to be kept in, and inside that was a fairly small twist of parchment with either letters or numbers or a map. And the great-grandfather of Marcel, Verger to Saunier, took it to Saunier, who looked at it rather dismissively and said, "Oh yes, it's a holy relic. Get about your business, Verger, please. Carry on with your cleaning." And within a few days, Béranger Saunier was the richest man in the south of France. Now, what was on that parchment? One of the theories is that it was a plan of the burial places of the Merovingians or the Visigoths who had been there centuries before and who had been buried with their treasure.
I see.
Now, Saunier had a confidant, the beautiful young Marie de Narnaud, who had come to him when she was 18 or 19, and he was then a guy in his 40s, and I think their relationship was just a little more than master and housekeeper. But he and Marie trusted each other totally. She was his confidant, and they used to go on long walks together. Now, my suspicion is that Marie was the lookout girl, while Saunier, with that parchment, found his way into a tomb in which the Visigothic treasures had been laid with the body.
A little teamwork here, Stay with us, Lionel. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Want to time travel? Go back to past shows on Streamlink. Sign up online at coasttocoastam.com.
Keep on moving. Keep on moving.